Welcome to MetaStrategy's 300th broadcast of the Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and over the past 9 years, I've had the enormous privilege to interview a great number of people who've shaped the technology landscape. These have included heads of state, technology CEOs, authors, and many chief information officers, among others. To our listeners, I want to express my sincere gratitude to you for listening along the way. This week, we have an interviewee befitting the occasion, as my guest is retired General Stanley McChrystal. He's the former commander of the U.S. International Security Assistance Forces, or ISAF, in Afghanistan, and the former commander of the Premier Military Counterterrorism Force Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC. He was responsible for developing and implementing the current counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan and for creating a comprehensive counterterrorism organization and revolutionized the interagency operating culture. General McChrystal co-founded the McChrystal Group in 2011. That organization's mission is to deliver innovative leadership solutions to American businesses to help them transform and succeed in challenging and dynamic environments. General McChrystal is a senior fellow at Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs, where he teaches a course on leadership and operation. He sits on the boards of Navistar International Corporation and JetBlue Airways. He's also the chair of Service Year Alliance, which advocates for a year of service for every young American. General McChrystal earned a Bachelor of Science degree from West Point and is a graduate of the U.S. Naval War College. He's completed fellowships at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government and at the Council on Foreign Relations. I recently caught up with General McChrystal in his office in Alexandria, Virginia, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, people, as the general described the qualities he looks for in a team and the benefits that can be gained from respecting the experiences and insights of all team members. We also discussed how the current speed of change requires agile decision-making, the impact of culture and organizational structure on an enterprise's effectiveness, the attributes and role of a leader, and a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you'd give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you.
Fortinet, the global leader in high-performance cybersecurity solutions, is a proud sponsor of the Forum on World-Class IT. The Fortinet Security Fabric delivers the broad, powerful, and automated protections today's organizations require to secure their evolving networks, from IoT to the cloud. Learn more at fortinet.com.
General McChrystal, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really pleased to spend time with you and to learn a bit about your experiences both in the military setting, but also now more recently in the private sector.
It's my pleasure. Call me Stan.
Oh, thank you. To say that you come from a military family is quite an understatement. Your father, your father's father were in the military, all of your four brothers, your father-in-law, all of his sons, your brothers-in-law. What I find so interesting about your narrative is your education and experience was based upon an environment that was largely predictable and where one's engagement with a foe was often country to country, as opposed to a much more complex set of circumstances that you found yourself in a post-9/11 world. In 2003, you took over the Joint Special Operations Command. And what I find so interesting is it was at that point when you, perhaps the insights come from earlier in your career, but it became very clear that the nature of warfare was changing dramatically and the military had to change along with it. And I wonder if we could begin there with some of those insights that were coming when you were on the ground and recognizing that what had worked in the past was not likely to work in the future.
Sure. Let me rewind a bit, because there's always going to be some people listening and they're going to go, wait a minute, change has been around forever.
Please.
And you particularly go back from the military sphere and you go back just as recently as the American Civil War. There were technological changes, the ability to do the telegraph, railroads, the mini ball, the rifled musket as opposed to a smooth bore. All of those things changed the nature of war. The First World War, when you had the advent of so much smokeless powder and things. And then Second World War with Blitzkrieg. So change always has occurred. The difference is, one, part of that change occurred over a much slower period. The tank appeared during the First World War. but really took a generation before it made a difference on the battlefield. So change was a pace that compared to now is glacial. Also, as you mentioned, most war, not all, but most was between nation states or things that felt like nation states. They might be Indian tribes or something, but they had many of the same attributes. So the reality is, for much of the period until about the last 20 years, things were at a pace and a level of complication that was manageable. You could be trained as a lieutenant coming out of West Point a certain way to organize forces and think about war and fight. And with some, you know, adjustments for the peculiarities of each situation, you were in pretty good shape. My grandfather entered during the First World War, and he was a colonel during the Second. And all the experience he had developed during those intervening years was relevant. The rifle that was used in the First World War was still used up until the beginning of the Second World War. So his competence was of value to him. What happened in the last 20 years is the pace sped up, just accelerated tremendously. And we crossed this line from things being complicated to things being complex. And when you cross that line, everyone says, okay, well, they're the same thing, aren't they? And no, they're not. Your car is complicated. You probably don't know how to fix it. You don't know how to build it. But when you press the button in the morning or turn the key, it does the same thing every time because it's designed to do that. Complex is a line in which the number of variables and the interconnectedness and the speed makes it impossible to predict what happens in the future. And so you say, now, wait a minute, people predict the future all the time, and how often do they get it right nowadays? And so the reality is, if you're in a world or an environment in which it's impossible to predict even the near-term future or the impact of your actions, then you have to approach it differently. And that gets to my experience starting in 2003. Whether I would have admitted this at the time or not, I was a product of a military upbringing. I was a product of a big organization optimized for efficiency. Now, you wouldn't say the U.S. military was efficient, but in every way it could be, it was as efficient as possible. It took young people in massive amounts of things, and it made as much predictable behavior as possible. When you gave an order, you expected certain things to occur. The purpose of doctrine and procedures and discipline and chains of command, all were around that. Then, starting in 2003, it first impacted me the most. I was already a major general. So I've been around quite a while. And we're in this environment in which the enemy in which we're engaged, with whom we're engaged, is a different beast. It's a networked, constantly changing thing. Not like a nation state. And not like a traditional terrorist group. But they are also operating in an environment that's fundamentally different. The speed of information and the impact of what you do. So now, if you pull a lever, you really don't know what's going to happen because they don't connect in the same ways. And if you pull the lever on Monday, pull the same lever Tuesday, you may get a completely different outcome. And you say, well, that's impossible. But it's not impossible. It is reality now. So we entered the 2003 fight in Iraq with, I was part of a counter-terrorist force that was purpose-built to destroy terrorist networks. And it had been trained and organized and culturally shaped very carefully for about 22 years since its inception, 1981, to do this really, really well. And then suddenly we're there at an environment which we can perform all we've been taught to perform, the highest standard we ever had imagined, and yet the outcome is not what we expected. And so now we're in an environment in which what we are doing may be technically and tactically correct. It is functionally incorrect because it's not working. That put us in a position with, what do you do? Because the first thing you do is, if you start to fail, you say, well, I'm not doing well. I got to try harder. I got to work weekends. I got to do something. And you try to do what you do, do it better, or be more disciplined, or yell at your people, or whatever works in an organization. This was not that. They were already working as hard as they could. They were bleeding. They were incredibly competent. They were just doing things right, but it became very, very evident that that was not going to be effective in that environment.
That's very interesting. And I've heard you liken JSOC historically to being the bullet, but that there were others who were aiming, who were determining what direction that bullet ought to go. But the transformation you needed to make was that JSOC became the gun.
That's exactly right. And because I used to refer to it as the bullet because we were this wonderfully engineered projectile that if it was aimed correctly and fired at the right moment, what we would hit, we would have perfect effect on. And it was comforting to be that. It's sort of comforting to be the experts, and you don't have to decide the strategy, and you don't have to worry about the politics. You just wait until they call, and you walk in. And, you know, if people don't get it right, that's too bad, but it's not your fault. And we just optimized what we were. Suddenly, we're in an environment where nobody has the vision or the effectiveness to aim the gun and pull the trigger except us. It has to be us. And you say, well, why does it have to be us? Because we are closer to the problem. We have sensors all over the battlefield. We're the only people who can effectively do that. Now, before, in the earlier years of the organization, we wouldn't have had sensors all over the battlefield, meaning our people and entities. We would essentially wait until somebody got the information, curated it for us, shaped it up, put in what we called a target folder, give it to us, and say, okay, that's what you want done, all right. We found nobody could do that. So the only way we could deal with this was become our own entity that figured out the problem and then executed. Now, the great impact on us is I used to describe people, JSOC used to be 80% operations and 20% intelligence. And our 20% intelligence, basically, we were consumers of intelligence. People would give it to us. We would critique it and whatnot, but then we would operate. A year or two after 2003, I used to tell people the command is now 80% intelligence and 20% operations. And those 20% of our operations, a good percentage of those were conducted entirely to get more intelligence. It was completely a fight for understanding. Who could understand fastest? Us or the foe? And if we could understand them well enough, we could win because the operational, the kinetic part of it, isn't the hard part. It's you can do it if you understand well enough. It's a little like the story of the guy who is brought in to work on the New York subways, and he brings a little hammer and he taps at a place and says, okay, do this. And then he charges them $10,000. And they came back and said, $10,000 to tap with a little hammer? He says, okay, you want an itemized bill? All right, $10 for tapping with a little hammer. $9,990 for knowing where to tap. That's what we became, the entity that had to know where to tap. And that was really hard. And that got us into an information age and an age of complexity that was unexpected.
Another analogy that I really liked was that you had risen in an environment where leaders like yourself were like chess masters, but you needed to think more of like gardeners. You needed to plant seeds. You needed to provide the fertilizer. But you needed to allow them to grow, and you needed to disseminate information in a way that they could make decisions without you, which was a very, very different from the traditional environment of information going up and a decision coming back down. Right. Can you talk a bit about the rationale there as well as the means of making a cultural change, which strikes me as very profound?
If you think back again historically, because I like to watch the sweep, if you look at Admiral Perry sent to open up Japan in the 1840s, he's essentially said, go do it. Let us know how it comes out. Because they couldn't micromanage him. Once he sailed, there was no way to communicate with him in a timely fashion. So all you could do is send him out with general orders and let him use his best judgment. Then we had an era where you had more and more communications. During the Civil War, you suddenly had a period where telegraph lines could run to in close proximity of the battlefield. So back in D.C., President Lincoln and others could actually send and receive reports, and they could browbeat the generals to do more and whatnot. And on the one hand, that feels helpful, but on another hand, they're not there. Then in the First World War, you had the tyranny of wires where general officers on the Western Front would have to be behind the lines. And they got great criticism for being chateau generals because they were back at these comfortable headquarters, not near the trenches. They had to be. There was no other choice because that's where the wires connected. there wasn't enough radio. There was an infancy. So they couldn't see anything other than the spot they were standing if they were forward. But if they were back with maps and all of the inputs, they had some chance of knowing what was going on. We let our entire corporate structure and our organizational structures grow that way. And we had pyramid-shaped structures where information goes up to the C-suite of the headquarters, who are the best informed people in the organization overall, because they had the ability to have all these conduits of information to them. And so they were logically the right people to come up with the plan, make the decisions, and send directed down. And as long as things are going slowly enough and don't change too often, that works in a fashion. You can become very efficient, and the person with the strategic sense and all the information is the best posture to make decisions. Then suddenly you get to a period where things are changing really fast and they're nuanced on the ground at the point of action. And you say, well, what do you do about that? Well, on the good side, you've got better information technology than ever before. So all we do is amp that up, bring more information to the headshed. We pump it up because we have video screens, we have constant information, we have cell phones, we have all this. So you can be connected to everywhere on the battlefield and pump up the information so the person at the top, at the apex of this pyramid, is, in the theoretical sense, perfectly informed and therefore, and hopefully the cleverest person in the organization, and therefore, the right chess master. Except it doesn't. It looks like it works, and if you draw this out, it kind of ought to work because we can communicate in real time from across. And so that person ought to be informed by all these different pieces of information, ought to then be able to get this contextual understanding no one else can have and make great decisions. But it doesn't work because they're not there. They're not close enough. In fact, what has happened is the speed of change down at points, the edge of the organization, are faster than even modern technology can communicate. And they're much more nuanced and they're much more complex, constantly changing and unpredictable. So this self-deceptive or potential for illusion that you can do this, be the chess master, is a loser's game. And yet people try it over and over because it ought to work. On the whiteboard, when you draw it out, it says it ought to work. And I'm a clever guy, so particularly for me. But then it doesn't work. And so you got to do the counterintuitive thing, which is turn it on its head, pump the information down, and say, wait a minute, I've got all this great information at my top of the organization, and I'm going to pump it to these people at the edge of the organization who are younger, less experienced, less everything. I'm going to give them, they won't know what to do with it. It'd be like a hog looking at a wristwatch. But it's not. Actually, you push the context down, and then you have to let them execute. It is counter to our nature. It's counter to what we talk about risk. The board of directors go, wait a minute, you know, you can't be pushing that kind of thing down. But you have to. And this is the thing that is so difficult for organizations and leaders to deal with, is that which feels illogical and uncomfortable is also the only thing that works. And so as I used to tell people, we are going to decentralize till we're uncomfortable and then decentralize more.
Incredible. One of the things that I find so interesting from A Team of Teams, your book, is that this whole nature of the centuria, of the 100-person team, thinking a little bit further and expanding on some of the themes we've already covered, the need to think in smaller groups as opposed to a single monolith or the traditional silos, either in the military or in business, as the more effective means of making decisions. So can you talk a little bit about that insight as well?
Sure. It's really based on human behavior and psychology. We know it. We want to keep none. And what I mean by that is, you know, your company or your organization gets big and you suddenly say, we are Team Ford. Everybody at Ford wears a Ford t-shirt and that they get up in the morning thinking of themselves as Team Ford. Well, I talked to a World War II veteran a few years ago. He had been in the 82nd famous division during the Second World War. And I asked him, okay, what were you in World War II? He says, 3rd Platoon. And I said, 3rd Platoon what? What company? What battalion? What regiment? I expected him to say, I was a paratrooper in the 82nd. He says, no, I was in 3rd Platoon. I smiled at that, and he said, that's the way I think about it. That's the way I thought about it. That's the way we identified. And so people identify with an organization of a size that their mind gets around. There's a lot of data that tells us that people stay in an organization and their level of engagement and happiness is based upon their immediate supervisor more than anything else. So we can hire a new CEO and get great leadership, but the reality is the thing that's making a difference closest to our customers, our clients, are first-line supervisors. And if they are not good, we're not going to retain, we're not going to be effective, and if they are, we will. And because individuals, and again, there's a lot of study that says there's a range of relationships you can maintain. The number thrown out is often 150. I would argue it might even be smaller in terms of real relationships. People that you'd call or you'd actually spend time with or lend money to or whatever defines a real relationship. Those are the things that move you. Those are the things that drive how you dress, how you think, really important things. And so this small grouping. So suddenly, if your organization's more than a small team, you say, how do I think about that? Because I want everybody to be one big happy family. They're not. They're going to be a bunch of little, hopefully happy families. And once you understand that, then you say, okay, well, I got all these little families inside my big family. Do I have a series of separate tribes? Have I now built silos that are walled off from each other? And the answer is too often yes, because small teams will do a lot of things for cohesion. They'll develop their own lexicon. They'll develop all these different cultural attributes, as well as sometimes being functionally different people in human resources or in finance. They have different backgrounds and expertise, so they're naturally going to band together. So if you realize you are going to have to have competence and cohesion at those small teams, don't fight it. That's not the idea. The idea, though, is how do you make the connection of those small teams as much like the connections between individuals within a small team as possible? What are those things that make the relationship between those teams not competitive or dysfunctional, but in fact complementary and functional? That's not the natural state, though. If you just, this is what I found, if you go and create an organization with a bunch of small teams, you say everybody get along, that don't make it so. The reality is, people and organizations will sort of drift apart. They will focus within themselves. They won't be openly negative to the other groups, but they won't be connected because there's just not a reason to be. It's a little bit of an unnatural state because it takes work, it's additional effort, it's culturally tiring. But if you're going to have an effective organization, you have to create that. Now, what we did in the 19th and 20th century with Max Weber and other things, studies of bureaucracy and organizational theory, is we said, okay, we're going to treat each of these organizations as a piece in the machine, and we're going to hook the pieces of the machine together, and if each piece works, then the machine works. And there's a certain logic to that as well. But there's a mechanical rigidity to that as well, because you have to create the machine to do predictable tasks over time to be efficient, and they will do the same thing over and over. When the tasks change, reorganizing, reconstructing the machine is hard. If you're only doing that every 2-3 years, oh, it's probably manageable. If it has to happen every day or multiple times every day, you can't mechanically do it, and the mechanical pieces won't work. So now you have to say, well, how do you create an organic connection across teams that's constantly shifting? And that's cultural. You can't write a process for it. You can create some things that help the process. You can create some forums in an organization that increase dialogue. You can create expectations of how people connect for on communities of interest or on tasks. You can do it. But the biggest part of this is cultural. People have got to think differently. They don't leave their team, or they don't stop being a member of human resources or whatever. That's just who they are, and they want to be that. But what you've got to do is convince them that there's a larger entity, the success of which is really the important metric of success. And they've got to see that, and they've got to feel that. And that takes work. I often refer to it as being like holding magnets together in opposition that are pushing themselves away from each other. And you say, well, why would I do that? Because that's the only time you can create the the effect of the organization actually being flexible and working fast. And it works. You can do it. It's just, it's a high-energy management. Leaders don't do this and then walk away and take the summer off. Leaders are constantly managing.
One of the things you've mentioned is you had the quote-unquote advantage in 03 of some methods that were not working, and that created a mandate for change. In the absence of that, I know that some of your clients are leaders in their industries, and if it ain't broke, why fix it? What are the most effective ways that you have seen to create that mandate when the data itself perhaps may be saying that it's not necessary?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Peter. The bottom line in a corporation, you know, profitability or whatever, often will say, no, we're okay. Why would we change? And there will be some strong advocates for the status quo, and they may be stockholders, they may be board members, they may be, you know, customers or whatever. But usually the organization knows. This is interesting. We have found this time and again. The organization does know it needs to change. And if you go inside the organization and you ask it, we formed a team within the Crystal Group called Team Discovery that goes in an organization, and it's led by a person who worked against Al-Qaeda in Iraq for it. We go in and we look and see, how's the organization really? There's an org chart, and there's a manual that says, this is how ACME whatever works. And that's never accurate, because culturally it works a bit differently than that, sometimes dramatically different. And the most important people aren't always the people with best offices and parking places. So we look at that and we understand that. And we ask the organization how it's running, and the organization invariably comes back with a different view. And it says, you know, there are a lot of things we have to do differently. You can create a sense of the need for change, a consensus for change there. But you also can go outside the organization, customers, clients, other people who interface with it, you get great feedback on it. And then the senior leadership has got to be prescient enough to be able to look toward the future. We have a wonderful TV clip we show here now and again of the CEO of Research in Motion, RIM, who makes BlackBerry in 2007. They ask him, well, what do you need to change? He says, nothing. We're good. It's all good. This iPhone's going to be a flash in the pan. Of course, their stock now is less than 10% of what it was then. And it's not his fault, because he's representative of a lot of people who, you know, if you're warm and dry, don't change. But you have to create a consensus that the need to change. And what we found almost invariably, the organization does know it. They may not say it out loud, but they do understand that on the front of where they are is uncertainty that is much greater than they might have seen in the past.
Mm-hmm. Another change that you've spoken about is so much of what we've described in terms of the pace of change, the network effects, the development of ecosystems, in many ways are mastered first by those who are the digital natives and therefore the younger people in organizations. And so counterintuitively, oftentimes it's necessary to tap them for insights because they simply have a more natural understanding of the things that are rising as important trends in the military or in business or beyond. And you've spoken about the need for reverse mentorship as a leader of an organization, as a leader of multiple organizations now. Can you talk a bit about the role that plays, the way in which one taps the younger resources in an organization for these sorts of insights?
Yeah, the first thing is, you said it correctly, with the change in technology and other things that have come with that, people operate their lives differently now. They do their business, whatever it is, they do it differently than they used to. They use different tools, mostly information technology, but a number of things. And it goes to now starting to be artificial intelligence and whatnot. So the work gets done differently. Not by everyone, but by a lot of people, and it's increasing that way. Management techniques and senior leaders tend to be older, tend to have grown up in a previous way. So in not every case are they against it, but they don't know it. And therefore, they're not comfortable driving it, or they just don't appreciate the fact that things are already done dramatically different than they were comfortable with. And so if the senior leadership remains oblivious to that, and they put out missives from on high, this is how we're going to do this, those will largely be ignored down in the trenches. And it will create this sense of disdain. People up the chain goes, well, those guys don't get it. Just, you know, ignore what they say because so-and-so. And a lot of what they say from the top may be very good, but it's all going to be devalued if they are out of touch with it. So to create a sense of respect at the bottom for the senior, you've got to be clued in at higher levels. But then at the lowest levels, because they are figuring it out, because they're going out and having this daily interaction with the world, with the market, with whoever, what we're doing, they're the people who are understanding what's working and what isn't. So you got to ask them. And it's another sign of respect. Go down and ask them what's working, what isn't working, what should we do? Now, in every case, they may not be entirely right. And they probably will never be entirely right. But they'll bring an additional perspective that goes together. What we found in the complex world we are now, we can't divorce what's working down there in a very granular sense from what we're seeing at a strategic level, a corporation or whatever. They've got to be connected in a way they never were before. Because people at the lower level have to understand that strategic context to make decisions that are appropriate. And the people at the top have to understand what's happening, or the strategy just doesn't make sense either. But that's a level of constant interaction that wasn't necessary before. It levels the playing field a little bit in a way that can be uncomfortable, because there was an era in which the senior people had more experience, more wisdom, more power, and so everybody else was considered appropriate if they were in the receive mode. Let the wise men and women who've done it all tell us what to do, and we'll sort of shut up. And if we say too much, it'll be disrespectful. And it's never been the reality that we shouldn't be listening, but it's just essential now that we create that dynamic where we listen. But it also, the leveling process can be unnerving for senior leaders, because you spend your life trying to become a senior leader, and then suddenly, you know, a 22-year-old is calling you Stan, which is what I tell them to do, or they're, you know, entirely equal to me on something, or think they are. There's a temptation to go, shut up and listen. I'll tell you where to color. Move out. And that's, I think, almost every, I'm not the only senior leader that's ever just wanted to do that. You know, tell all the millennials, get in the back room and I'll throw coloring books in there and they can pass out what they've done. But it ain't right. It doesn't work at the end of the day. You're much better to harness that energy, to allow that energy to work. But provide what you do bring, which is there's a contextual wisdom to experience. There's real value in it. I would argue that as we go through these things, that value may even be going up. So very experienced, clever people are going to be more valuable than ever before. They're not going to be irrelevant, but they got to be connected. They can't be ivory tower wise.
Yeah. It strikes me your transformation from the military to the private sector. One of the trends that has come to the private sector that feels a lot more like some of what you've experienced through your military experience is cybercrime, cyber warfare, the nation-sponsored, in many cases, actors against private sector businesses. And I wonder, I don't have a very specific question for you, but I'd be interested to see how your thinking has evolved as you've seen and counseled companies, some of whom have been the victims of these sorts of attacks against them. And as we talk about opportunities rising through the development of ecosystems, there are now ecosystems that are working against them, as opposed to Coke and Pepsi competing against each other. It's a much more nebulous sort of competitive set of forces, so to speak, that are working often against businesses today as well. I'd be interested in your perspectives.
No, I think that's a very good description. If we start sort of the strategic and work down to the on the ground, at the strategic level, we don't know what to make of cyber yet. Our organization is in nature. We're creating Cyber Command, the National Security Agency. We're starting to view cyber as a domain, like space, like the sea, like ground. And that's going to be a place in which nations compete. We don't completely feel comfortable with it, because the problem with cyber is it's not quite like anything else. Because cyber, if you start at one end, it is commerce and whatnot, but then it's espionage. And then you cross a line in which it's not espionage anymore, it's something different. Stealing secrets and leaking them, which is an act. It's like an act of war. Or going in and attacking SCADA systems and other things and creating disruption, almost like a kinetic strike. We haven't yet gotten our mind around where the line is, where it is an act equivalent to dropping a bomb. Because you could be much more damaging with some of these other actions. Even though they don't have the same feel as a bullet or a missile or a bomb, they are more damaging. So the first thing is we have to decide that, where that line is. We, the United States, won't decide, sort of society of the world will. But it's going to have to get drawn and looked at. And then you're going to say, okay, well, somebody does this across this line. I am legally and morally okay if I respond disproportionately, maybe kinetically, maybe I bomb them. Until you get some construct that people understand, we're not going to be able to have deterrence. If you go back to nuclear doctrine, it was all based upon deterrence. Rational person on the other side, you bomb me, I'll bomb you. I got it. And so you won't. And that works as long as you have rational people and you have clearly understood sort of set of rules. We don't yet have a set of rules for cyber. And between nation states, if we had those, we could probably do deterrence. And we're playing with it, as you can see now. What makes it even harder, though, and it's getting harder with things like weapons of mass destruction, is they're no longer held only by responsible nation states that you can hold at risk. So if you have a nuclear weapon and you're a terrorist, I can't necessarily deter you by saying I will bomb your capital and you haven't got one. Well, I'll kill you. He said, I don't care. Now we're in a different game because you can't deter someone who doesn't care. It applies in weapons of mass destruction, which is chilling. It applies in cyber even more because, first off, what do you respond against? You may attack, you know, the computers they used. Maybe an individual, maybe a non-nation state actor, or maybe a gray area. Individuals like buccaneers, you've got letters of mark from queens that says it's okay to be a buccaneer, and that's because who do we go after, the queen or the buccaneer? And the cyber part is just so easy. Cost of entry is almost nothing. You can literally have a computer, and if you're fairly clever, you can get in the game on a low-level sense. So that's the big deterrence part of it. When we get down to companies and whatnot, what I see is it's really hard because most companies want to buy, pay for cybersecurity, and they don't know how much because the senior leaders don't really understand it. Even young people want to talk about real serious cybersecurity. So you say, well, how much should we spend? And you kind of look left and right to see what your peers are spending. And you say, well, we ought about spend about that much money. And there's no idea whether that's enough or too much or whatever. It's just you're trying to mitigate, buy down the risk on something that you don't understand well enough to know if you're really buying down the risk. And so you go, wow, that is really disconcerting because even a big expenditure might not be appropriate. And then as we get into the human factors as well, protecting against internal threats, employees is incredibly difficult. So now we say, all right, if you work for a company, Pete, they may read every email, listen to every phone call you make. They watch your access badge. They know when you're coming out. They know if you change your behavior. If suddenly in October you start going in hours when you never went in before, they're going to look and say, what's going on? We are entering this time and when cyber is so frightening and yet so potentially damaging. Now, one thing that will have to happen is publics are going to have to get more mature about it. And what that means is, years I've been saying and believing that in an upcoming election, what was going to happen is someday somebody was going to leak information on a candidate on Sunday. It would be totally false. They would have somebody come in with corroborating information on Monday, which was totally false. The election would happen Tuesday, impacted by that. And then about Thursday, people figured out it's false, but it's done. We sort of had that in the American presidential election this time. Not quite that timeline, but very similar. And most American voters couldn't understand what had happened, what was true, what wasn't. I don't think we still know. And at least we don't think we do. And so as a consequence, all we know is we don't feel as confident that the information that we were seeing is right as we once did. Now, people have always used propaganda and lies and whatnot, so that isn't new. But the idea we can so insidiously undermine our sense of what's correct and what isn't correct, That's really disturbing. And then the speed aspect of it, because it goes so fast, it creates this sort of firestorm. I tell people we can now communicate much faster than we can think. And lots of media and people feel the need to do that. And if they really stepped back and they spent a bunch of time thinking about it, how's this going to play out for them or for the thing, they might do differently. But we're hardwired not to do that now. And we're seeing that that works. We're seeing that the immediate response, whether it's an immediate apology by a company to something or whether it's a counterattack or it's a politician doing something, actually that works. And because that works, I think we are breeding a bad behavior. And I don't know how to back away from it. In the near term, I don't know what will be the way we really solve that.
I'm curious, as you developed the Crystal Group over the past several years, what sort of backgrounds have you sought to surround yourself with in developing a business?
Sure. When we work with clients, we have to have a number of things. We have to have a good product offering, which means we've got to have intellectual property that's underpinned with academic rigor that's right. And so we built a concept and design team that does study on the academic literature, behavioral science, all things. We can't be not built on a foundation of things that are credible and legitimately proven. At the front end of it, what we tend to have is people with practical experience, people who've been out leading things before, managing whatnot. And that's a combination of people with military or CIA or experience and business experience. And we try to meld those so that you've got people who, in some cases, have led a whole lot of people in complex environments. In other cases, they've been responsible for profit and loss. So we find that the people who actually interface with our clients have got to be people our clients will listen to. It's pointless to have the right answer if people won't listen to you. So a certain amount of credibility, presence, charisma, but enough experience across the civilian and military, a combination of that, is really, really important. Then we bring in young people because they bring understanding on things. They've got different views. They learn really quickly. And we meld those into teams. And it has been very effective. We're different from many firms in that we don't come in and tell an organization what the answer to their problem is. Sometimes you'll hire people and say, well, what's my problem? And they'll come in, they'll study the problem, they'll give you a set of slides. And go, there's your problem. Give us a check. Good luck. We don't do that. We go in and we work with them and says, let's figure out what your problem is. And then we say, okay, let's fix it. We'll stay here with you. And then we don't fix it for them. We put a very small team with them and we say, okay, we're going to help. Let's move to a good outcome. That's worked very well for a couple of reasons. One, anybody can tell you or I how to be in better health. Don't smoke, don't drink much, eat right, sleep enough, work out. You got that. But it helps to have somebody helping you do it. You know, we hire personal trainers, nutritionists, all. We kind of help people do that. So it's sometimes through their conscience and we push them. Plus, people are very, very busy. And as you're trying to make changes in an organization, how it works, and people are just busy as can be trying to make quarterly results, etc., as they almost always are, it's hard. And it goes on the back burner. And they go, yeah, we know we want to change. And we found very effective for us to come in and help them be that part of that change. Not to own it. They got to own it. But to help them make that change that would just be too hard standing on by themselves.
Can you describe your role a little bit more, the many hats that you're wearing within this business as well?
Yeah, you probably ought to ask the company. They'd probably say not much. I think the first thing I am is try to be a stamp of credibility on it. You know, I put my reputation. I underwrite everything we do or fail to do, and I look CEOs in the eye and say, we're going to deliver. This is what we can do. And that's important because it gives it a personal aspect that some corporations, it's harder for them to do. The second thing is I try to be a leader in the organization because business is challenging and it goes up and down and left and right. And sometimes you have to lead your own team. I'm also very involved in shaping the team in terms of who we bring in, what the right size of it is, what the right composition is, what the culture here is. Now, I don't claim to create the culture here. I input on the culture. The culture is created by this interaction between all the people, and it's constantly morphing. But I'm very interested and involved in how we do that, from creating the physical spaces to creating the right mix of people to do it. But the actual work with clients, I tend to work with CEOs. So we'll have a long-term engagement with a corporate client. I will tend to interact with the CEO, but I won't do most of the work in the relationship. But I'll be the connection with the CEO, part coaching, part, you know, keeping things focused, getting feedback, because that's about appropriate. Me too involved is just going to screw it up. That's one of the things I've learned.
One of the themes, I think, across our conversation is the need for learning agility. And I wonder, what are the ways that you make sure that you are agile in your learning, that you're remaining current as your advisor to people? I mean, what's been great in this conversation is your vast understanding of history and a bit of an understanding as to where it's repeating itself, but also understanding the fundamentally new. I'm curious how you continue to develop that balance.
We start with the assumption that I am, which could be a challenge. but if I am, it's busy. I'm constantly engaged in what we do and what we're learning in that prospect. One of the great things about this is we work with a whole bunch of different organizations. So you see different organizations constantly, and every organization does a bunch of things really well in that sector. And I find that very fascinating. I also go to a number of events every year, conferences and things like that, that pull me into that. Sometimes I'm speaking at them, but often I'm just taking it in. And that's a constant check on what you're thinking yourself. Because if you stand in front of a bunch of accomplished people and say something stupid, you'll figure it out over time that you are. But also, people will just, you're constantly exposed to it. From a science standpoint, I find it interesting. From a business standpoint, I find it interesting. There's just not enough hours in a day to take it all in. And then we're starting yet another book. We just released One Mission, which was a sequel to Team of Teams. My partner wrote that. It's a brilliant book. But we're now starting another book on leadership, where we're trying to raise the conversation of leadership. We've been kind of tactical, you know, walking around leadership things. We're trying to raise it. We're using Plutarch's Lives as a model. And we're trying to say, why did Plutarch write about these people? What did he say? Who should we be looking at as leaders now? What should we be saying about them? And what should we be thinking about? It's a really interesting process because it makes you step back just a little bit and say, all right, leadership has been, I don't know, almost made two-dimensional. We say a leader is a leader if they're a celebrity, if they got a lot of Facebook friends, if they've got a lot of Twitter followers, if they've got a big paycheck, if they've got, you name it, any number of these sort of two-dimensional things that are metrics. I don't think they're metrics of leadership. I think they're metrics of something else. Now, they might be a leader. There might be one in there if you scratch the surface, but there might not be. And so what we're trying to do is study this. What is leadership really? What is the difference between someone who is hugely impactful on a field or something, but doesn't have the same celebrity? Or what about somebody who does everything right, follows all the checklists? They do all those leader behaviors, and they've got all the attributes and the education and everything. You say, got to be a great leader, but they constantly fail. What's the difference? What's happening there? Maybe all those checklists aren't right. Maybe the checklists are, you know, over 6 feet tall, straight teeth. Remember the CEO thing? The percentage of CEOs over 6 feet and all this is just huge. And yet the percentage of CEOs who succeed in one company, go to another company and succeed again is pretty small. And say, now, wait a minute, if the leader didn't change, then what were the actual drivers of success or failure? So maybe our assessment of the leader being the all critical variable may not be right. And I'm coming to that conclusion late in life, but it's really, really interesting to me.
It's wonderful. Well, Stan, thank you so much for taking time with me today. It's been a really fascinating conversation.
Peter, my pleasure. Thank you for taking the time.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT and our 300th broadcast. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Please join us for next week's broadcast when my guest will be Julia Davis, the Chief Information Officer of Aflac, the $22 billion supplemental insurance company.
Fortinet, the global leader in high-performance cybersecurity solutions, is a proud sponsor of the Forum on World Class IT. The Fortinet Security Fabric delivers the broad, powerful, and automated protections today's organizations require to secure their evolving networks, from IoT to the cloud. Learn more at fortinet.com. just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.